Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots, and happy Earth Day. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-term journalist of reporting on health, food, and the environment in a variety of outlets, including Alternet, Truthdig, The Huffington Post, EcoWatch, and many, many more. You can find my blogs there, and we'll reference some of them today on the show as well. I host this show, Connect the Dots, on the Progressive Radio Network, and have done so for the last 4 years, because, you know, we all have different interests, we all have different focuses, and it's important to be able to see the big picture and to connect the dots between all of the different things that go on in our world, in our communities, in the earth itself, that influence our health and well-being and that of other species and life forms here on earth. And that's what we do every week on this show. We connect the dots between health as we and all living beings experience it in our total environment. For the last 2 months, as regular listeners will know, I've been reporting on the trade deals, TPP, TTIP, and others, as well as the moves to fast-track them through the Congress, to speed them through without their provisions being known. At this time, I think I've probably done around a dozen or 15 or so different programs. You can search the Connect the Dots archives in order to listen to past shows that go back as far as a year ago when these treaties were first coming up for a vote, and were defeated in that round, fortunately, in 2014, and now they're back again in 2015 with a bigger push by the President, President Obama, to get them passed. So I've been covering them pretty steadily for the last 2 months. As regular listeners will know, I'm one of the first, in fact, the first news cycle reporter to cover fracking. I've covered health and food, GMOs, organic foods, and a whole wide range of how we look at health and healthcare, and how we take care of our environment. We've covered climate change on this show. So I'm sure many people began wondering when I first covered this, why are we talking about these trade treaties? Isn't it the business, you know, of the government to sort of figure that whole thing out? And what does the average health conscious person know about trade, think about trade, or regard trade as in any way being relevant to all of the issues that affect our health? Well, in fact, there is great relevance because, if we tell people to eat healthy food and we don't have a healthy food supply, that's relevant to health. If people need medicines and they don't have access to them, that's relevant to health. If we need a healthy environment in order to have a stable ecology here on Earth and all of the biodiversity that we need and the healthy water, air, and earth that we need to live, to support life here on this planet, if we make social policy choices that negatively impact those critical areas, we'll pay the price with our well-being and our health and in all kinds of different ways. And unfortunately, these so-called treaties, which I refer to as deals, contain many, many, many different provisions that strike at the root of all that we take for granted as being available to us to protect our health and to safeguard and nourish our health. And that's why I've been covering them so extensively. If you go into the Connect the Dots archive, you'll see that over the last couple of months, I've had special shows that discuss this from an angle of food, from an angle of the environment, from an angle of democracy, from an angle of sovereignty, our ability to make decisions as a society together, rather than having laws made by international, multinational corporations which supersede our own American laws and the rights that we have and that our fellow citizens have to make the right social policy choices that create health for ourselves, our families, and future generations. And so when I first began reporting, and this is very familiar to me from my work in fracking, you know, a lot of people didn't know what I was talking about. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know why there was an issue. Now, over the last 2 weeks, this has been, a deal was reached in Congress, and this is coming up very soon for a vote, possibly as early as this week or the next week. And that's why there's been a kind of ramp up with more people talking about this, and that's why you're knowing about it, you're acting on it, listeners, you're engaging with your friends and relatives and colleagues and letting them know about it and encouraging them to act on it is so critical now in making sure that these deals, which really are a big vote against a whole lot of public rights and needs, do not pass Congress. So today we'll be talking about this specifically with my guest today through the kind of angle of organizing, you know, what some of the activities that are going on that reveal the opposition and that people are engaging with, can engage with, and, you know, why we should be engaging with them. We'll be discussing that with today's guest, Adam Weissman. He's an organizer with Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, an organization that addresses the threat posed by free trade agreements to animals, the environment, safe, ethical, and sustainable food, and human rights of environmental defenders. Adam is doing a ton of work, and in a lot of the activities that are going on, you know, he's right there at the forefront. And I know that's especially true here in the Northeast and in New York metro area. Adam also represents, his group and is one of the members of Trade Justice New York Metro, a coalition of organizations from diverse social justice and environmental movements that are all working together. And, you know, this coalition model is something we'll also talk about today because I just think it's so incredibly important. You know, having covered a lot, you know, part of my theme here is connect the dots, so I cover a lot of the diverse movements that are working towards specific targeted goals, whether it's labeling GMO foods in our food supply, whether it's protecting our communities from both the climate change impacts as well as the local impacts and the local pollution impacts, the fracking and pipelines and all the rest of it. But what tends to happen is that each group targets, you know, their specific niche. And then when it comes to a big issue like that, like these trade deals, which affect all of us, you know, some people, some groups are involved and some just keep kind of going on like on and on about their specific issue, and they don't understand that these deals will supersede all of the, you know, things that they're working toward. And one of the reasons they don't understand is that it's been very underreported in the press and in the media. So we'll also talk about that today. So I'm so thrilled to have with us someone who's just been like a real superhero as an organizer in so many different fronts. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Adam Weissman.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for your kind words.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We've been kind of, Adam has helped orient me to some of the goings-on with all of this. In the time, let's just talk about how, you know, because I think you're really well-placed to kind of see this, how well-informed the public was when you began organizing this issue, how well-informed people are now, and how people respond when they really understand what the risks are of passing these deals.
Well, you know, I think because the corporate media has done such a, well, I won't say a bad job, I'll say such a good job of protecting the interests of their corporate bosses by not talking about these issues, people to a significant degree still are not aware of the threat posed by these trade deals. I think where there has been a real change is people who are already plugged into organizing in one form or another have come to realize that regardless of, on just about such a wide range of issues that many of us work on, many of the issues that you mentioned before about fracking and GMOs, in terms of labor rights and access to medicines, in terms of animal welfare and protecting family farms, in terms of data privacy and internet freedom, in terms of protecting our banking regulations and protecting our labor rights and jobs, there are so many different interests that are potentially under attack by these trade agreements, and people who are actively engaged in working on many of these concerns, I think now really have a sense, particularly with TPP, of what is at stake here, and increasingly as well with the other two agreements that the Obama administration is negotiating, the Trade and Investment Partnership and the Trade in Services Agreement. Now, all that activism has, I think, begun to start translating to getting across to the public, but it has been a challenge because the Fourth Estate has not really been has been not so much asleep at the wheel, but very much in operating in the corporate interest. The same organizations that the media organizations that are supposed to be telling us critical stories, many of the corporations that own those outlets are actually part of the corporate lobbying coalitions pushing agreements like TPP. Companies like Viacom and News Corp and Time Warner are actually part of the U.S. Business Coalition for TPP. So it's a fundamental conflict of interest between their role as journalists and their financial interest in these trade deals. And so
what you're saying is that, on the one hand, what you're saying is that we're not hearing about this as we need to, because, you know, from somewhere the word has kind of gone down, you know, and we'll never know for sure. So when you say this, you know, we weren't part of the editorial meeting where a senior editor, you know, nixed a story and everyone got the message, hey, we don't cover this. You know, it's probably not a memo that circulated and it said, you know, there's not going to be a smoking gun where you have a memo that said, no, we're not covering this. But, you know, it was just, and I worked inside the news media, so I know exactly how this is done. You know, it just becomes, you know, it's, oh, this, you know, they passed on it when someone proposed it, and then everyone got the message, or there was a state, you know, sort of a side comment made here and there. And, you know, reporters, if they want to keep their jobs, you know, they want to do what the editor wants. You know, they have mortgages to pay and everything else. And you know, that's how it goes down. So, you know, it's not like we're ever going to find out for sure. And then when you point out that this is how it operates, people will say, oh, conspiracy theory, or you're paranoid or something. But in fact, you know, it does kind of operate that way, that stories are killed or topics aren't covered. Somebody who shall be nameless told me that, you know, that I've interviewed covering these issues, said that, you know, in Europe there's like a pylon of people that want to interview and talk to him. And in this country, he was actually told by a reporter in a, you know, one of the very most prominent news media outlets, oh no, you know, our policy is we're favorable to the president and we don't want to say anything about this and we're not covering it in any substantive way. I mean, we do have, for example, MSNBC, where Ed Schultz has been covering it, but he is less highly watched, his highly regarded. His time, the time of his show is not during, you know, the more prime time slots. So when people look to, you know, Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow, who, you know, come at, you know, more of the sweet spot of when people are watching the news, you know, they're not covering it, but Ed Schultz is allowed to. So that's kind of deniability. Yeah, we're covering it. Or when it is covered, you know, some of the coverage is slanted or shaped. I mean, can you comment on any of that?
Well, I think the perfect example of that is actually yesterday on MSNBC, when Chris Matthews had President Obama. Chris Matthews reported from his panel that he moderated of President Obama and President Obama's fellow TPP pushers all expressing one side of the story, and then had, quote, President Obama quoted talking about how Elizabeth Warren is wrong on this. I love Elizabeth Warren, but she's wrong on this. And, of course, didn't have anyone on offering the other side of that story. He's mentioned that he has had people on who've given the other side of that story before. He mentioned they had on Sherrod Brown and Marcy Kaptur. But given how infrequently this story is reported, it's pretty interesting that he chose to give this one-sided account yesterday. But we really, it's true that in the broadcast media, the issue has really, by and large, been altogether ignored. And this is not just, that's not just speculation. I mean, that's not just a casual observation. This is something that's been studied by Media Matters for America. There have been a series of studies looking at coverage, and they found that they studied for specific periods between August 1st, 2013 and January 31st, 2014, ABC, CBS, and NBC Network News never once mentioned TPP. The only news outlet, the only evening news show that even mentioned it at all, and it was mentioned one time, was the PBS NewsHour. Then on cable, during that same period, Fox mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership no times. There's CNN, it looks like, mentioned it. It's a little hard to tell from this graph. It looks like I mentioned it about one time. And then just the complete outlier, as you mentioned, is MSNBC, where it's mentioned over 30 times. And so there really is this complete blackout in the broadcast media. In the print media, you see more discussion of it. A lot of it is very slanted. Occasionally, there is you see room for other sides of the story coming through here and there. The New York Times has had some decent op-eds on the issue. On the other hand, their editorial on Fast Track could have been written as a press release by the Obama administration, in talking about how Congress needs to pass Fast Track in order to have a say in these trade agreements. Well, that's absurd. Congress gets a say in these trade agreements by a thing called the Constitution. The New York Times may want to read Article 1, Section 8, Clause B of the Constitution to understand that Congress has a say in these things, the Commerce Clause, and doesn't need to be ceding authority to the president, giving the president authority to negotiate trade agreements and then tie Congress's hands behind their back and turning them into a rubber stamping agency through Fast Track to have a say in trade agreements. Congress has that say in the first place. So
let me just interject here for any listeners who are new to this. Basically, what the Fast Track means is that they give the president, there's specific legislation that gives the president trade promotion authority, which means he can sign these agreements and will be signing these agreements without full public transparency as to their provisions or full access to them and disclosure to Congress. Congress, if this Fast Track legislation, which is what is about to be coming forth in the Senate and then soon the House, would grant, is in fact, you know, this ability to sign without the possibility of making later changes. If anything, once the treaty contents are known, is seen to be egregious or problematic, there's no adjusting once this is signed, and that is what Fast Track is referring to. But you know, Adam, you bring up a really interesting point, which is, you know, when this is a complex thing. I remember when I was first covering fracking, people were just like, well, you know, the companies made the assertion, oh, it's safe, and then explaining why it isn't safe and all the different things about it that aren't safe, and explaining about the Halliburton loophole, how it's not regulated in the way of other industrial activities and was specifically exempted from them by this loophole in the energy bill that was instituted by former Vice President Richard Cheney. Right. So, you know, there was a lot of explanation. So and the TPP and these trade deals, they're much more complicated. There are several deals. They have different provisions. They act in different ways. So when you have a very complex thing, on the one hand, a sense of, oh, trade deals, what do I know about them? Well, what should I be doing about them? And, you know, in the public mind, and then you have the media in the middle, not covering them, not reporting on them, or not doing so in a balanced way, then, you know, there's really a lot of ignorance on the topic and a sort of steeper ramp up to understanding the problem. I mean, even the example you cite where the president critiques Elizabeth Warren's view, and Elizabeth Warren's view is not presented. Elizabeth Warren is not invited on to defend her view, you know. So it's kind of a one-sided thing. And as you point out with what you were saying about the Constitution, you know, the rationale of the New York Times for why, you know, we need to be part of this is, you know, in order to have a say, and you're pointing out that contradicts specific rights given to Congress in the Constitution. See, that is also a complexity. Most people aren't as aware as you are of the fact that what is the claimed rationale is already provided, right? So unless you really have studied or know that section of the Constitution, when you hear something like this stated, it sounds perfectly reasonable. And if it comes from a known authority or a media authority, you know, you're not going to sit down and go, oh, wait, that isn't so, actually. Instead, you're going to say, well, that sounds reasonable to me. End of story. I don't need to look into this further, you know, without actually knowing that it's a specious argument. And that, I think, is a big part of the problem. Have you any further comments on that? Have you seen that operating elsewhere?
Well, I think that you hear a lot of people talking about TPP and TTIP as a Trojan horse. In Europe, there's been this giant inflatable Trojan horse that's been used as a symbol for the protest. It's a beautiful prop, actually. But and I think that it's a really good metaphor for what these deals are about. The what makes TPP and TTIP so insidious is that this is basically a corporate coup buried in the most boring and jargonistic possible vehicle. This you know, trade agreements do not sound like an exciting thing. And so what they've done increasingly is used so-called trade agreements as a tool for writing domestic policy outside of our actual system of outside of our legislature, and then ceding, not only having Congress cede the power for to negotiate these trade agreements to the administration, but then in the long term, really our government ceding its ability to have the final word on its own laws through this system of international tribunals that will be created by these trade agreements. But when you that doesn't sound like what a trade agreement is. A trade agreement that sounds, to the degree that people have a concept of what that is, that sounds like, well, this is a way to create jobs by increasing exports. It doesn't sound like this is a way to take away your freedom of the internet or to give corporations the power to police and monitor your internet use. That's not something that, that's not something that people in a million years could think would have anything to do with a trade agreement. People wouldn't think that a trade agreement would have anything to do with giving a corporation the power to sue the state of New York potentially if a foreign investor doesn't like our fracking ban. These are not things that people associate with trade agreements. So basically tucking all these things into a seemingly innocuous vehicle is a good tactic. Things like SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, when they were out in the open, were killed. When you tuck something like SOPA inside something like TPP, it's a, and then lock people out of even seeing the negotiating process through treating the documents of these negotiations as classified documents that 600 advisors, mostly from corporations, have access to, but journalists don't. And until recently, members of Congress had extremely limited access, and civil society groups are largely unable to see. And then you have this great vehicle for passing secret policy. And then you go from these secret negotiations to this fast-track process where you have this sort of armored legislation, this legislation that's passed in a box that can't be opened. And unlike any other piece of legislation, Congress can rip apart any bill it wants. It can add amendments and riders and take out language and add all kinds of things. And so that, you know, what comes out of the end of the process looks very unlike what it started with. These fast-track trade deals are package deals that really can't be changed. So these basically these corporate we get these sort of packaged encapsulated corporate rights agreements delivered to Congress and Congress pretty much told, here, put your rubber stamp here, the president signs it, and he's happy, and his corporate donors who got him elected are happy, and the rest of us are pretty much locked out of the process, both in the creation of these trade agreements and in the future of our democracy, which is undermined by them.
And then the next thing, which, you know, that I'm sure people who are tuning in for the first time to this topic may be thinking, or that I hear people, you know, thinking or wondering, I think you just did, you know, one of the most brilliant and concise, you know, analyses and description of the overall problem. Now, we know that this is the problem. You know that it's a problem. I know that it's a problem. Regular listeners to my program who've heard various experts from different organizations speak understand that in fact you have completely accurately defined the problem here. The reason we know that is that people in Europe and WikiLeaks have leaked some of the provisions. So some of these provisions, which were supposed to be totally secret, are known. So based upon what has been leaked and surmised and discussed and what people have told from Europe have told their American colleagues and everything about, from all of that, we know the different things that are kind of going on. If it weren't for those things, they would be completely secret, and we'd just be standing here scratching our heads. But because that information is known, we do know a lot of specific areas where, that reveal that this is the agenda. Exactly what you just described is the agenda. We wouldn't know it without the leaking of these provisions. So, and we've discussed a lot of them on the show. We'll go through some of them here as well again today. But we haven't actually talked about the Internet freedom issue on this program. And since that's the example you used, I'd love to hear your report on that. Like, how would the deals undermine Internet freedom and access?
It's really one of the aspects of the trade agreements that really, more than any other, has this sort of big brother is watching you aspect of the trade of these trade agreements. When we hear about these trade agreements, they're pitched as free trade agreements, and it's all about creating freedom and eliminating restrictions, and so it's the libertarian dream: less government, less regulation, less red tape. And you really see just what an utter fabrication that is. How that is just such blatantly propaganda. When you look at the issues around these trade agreements and internet freedom, the intellectual property rules of these trade agreements are such that the American Civil Liberties Union has described TPP as the biggest threat to free speech and intellectual property that you've never heard of. The Electronic Frontier Foundation says that TPP is, in an interview with the ACLU, says that TPP is a major threat to free speech, privacy, and due process. Essentially, the TPP and agreements like it will turn the internet will criminalize everyday use of the internet. It forces service providers to collect and hand over your private data without privacy safeguards. Gives media conglomerates more power to fine you for internet use. Can remove online content, including entire websites, and even terminate your access to the internet. And by the way, some of what I'm pulling here is from. Actually citing directly from a website, stopthetrap.net, that I really encourage people to go to and sign the petition there that addresses this issue of how TPP attacks our internet freedom. And so I'm quoting directly. They also say that TPP will create a parallel legal system of international tribunals that will undermine national sovereignty. We've talked about that a little already, and allow conglomerates to sue countries for laws that infringe on their profits. So TPP criminalizes everyday use of the internet. But of course, we won't know the full extent of this until we see the final text of the secret deals. People have talked about things like simple everyday use of the internet that many of us would never think of as being criminal activities. Things like your computer creating a buffer copy of a file, or buying a recipe off the internet and emailing it to a relative. These could be criminalized activities. We could see a vast expansion of intellectual property rules that extend beyond things that we would normally think of as fair use. For people creating fanfic, doing stories about TV characters and comic book characters and things like that, or doing fan illustrations, those kind of things could be infringements on corporate intellectual property. Just the things that we think of as everyday activities could potentially be criminalized by this vast expansion of corporate property rights. So you have to ask, how is this free trade? How is this freeing anything? This is not about, so a lot of us, when we talk about free trade agreements, we use that phrase in quotes, because these really are not free trade agreements. They're not job creation agreements. They're corporate rights agreements. That's really what they are. These are about expanding the special interests of specific corporations who have there's not some overarching economic ideology to it. This isn't some economic principle at work. This is specific companies getting what they're pushing for because they have well, because the Monsanto lobbyist, the former CropLife lobbyist, is appointed to run the agriculture chapter, because the former Citigroup executive is the head of the office, is the U.S. Trade Representative. Alan Grayson, the congressman, has said that the office of the U.S. Trade Representative is like a corporate revolving door. People come out of corporate jobs, go into government to carry out the interests of the corporations they used to work for, and then go back into private jobs and are richly rewarded for having done a good job of screwing over the public and betraying the public trust in their public jobs. People also start in these agencies and then sell out the public in order to make themselves attractive to the corporations, who then happily hire these Judases of the public interest into corporate jobs, since they have shown their ability to sell their souls in the corporate interest. So we have a rogue agency that is doing nothing more than advancing the narrow interests of the 1%, writing our quote-unquote trade legislation that is really just about eviscerating our public interest legislation, undermining the Constitution, attacking our sovereignty, and doing it on behalf of companies like Monsanto and Halliburton and Walmart and Cargill, the companies that are threatening our environment, killing our jobs, raising our medicine prices. The companies that are concerned only about profit and certainly not about any of us. So they're using these trade agreements to strip away the things that protect us, to limit our power to actually have access to our own government, to create laws that protect us, really just putting nothing in the way of rapacious corporate greed, and not only doing it in the form of getting rid of the laws that protect us, but actually creating laws that that advance corporate interest. So it's not a big government versus small government thing. It's a hijacking of government by corporations for their own self-interest thing.
That sounds, you know, really horrible and egregious. How would they specifically create new laws? Because, you know, I mean, of course, if there's an existing law, and you use the example of the New York fracking ban, it's not a law exactly, but it's a local ordinance or ruling. If an existing ordinance, ruling, law, or regulation deprives a company of its future profits, as, you know, has been stated, and this provision is quite well known through the WikiLeaks leak of those provisions, then these companies would have the right to sue governments. Now, you know, in an international tribunal made up of corporate lawyers, you know, the benchmark is not like what is the health or environmental impact versus the economic impact. In this case, the economic impact is the only value that supersedes. In other words, was the corporation deprived of future profits or not? If they were, then the local government, state or nation, has to pay. So that's what those provisions are about. So obviously, if that goes through, a few lawsuits like this and a few states having to pay through the nose, I was looking at a ingredient list on a product, and it said, it contained an agreement that is not regulated by federal level, national level, toxic chemical regulations, but the state of California, being more environmentally conscious, has put in place regulations to inform the public of known problematic ingredients. And so, therefore, it said the state of California says that this ingredient, you know, is a carcinogen or whatever. Well, that kind of label goes bye-bye because it is perhaps deterring somebody from buying that food, that, you know, body care product, that baby blanket or whatever is, you know, this ingredient is contained in. So that acts as a deterrent to know that, you know, big brother globally, these companies are looking over your shoulder to what you rule or do or whatever protections are put in place to see if any, you know, it's going to deter anyone from buying their product. So it has a chilling effect. But you just mentioned specifically new laws that would potentially further instate this same legal prioritization of corporate profit over every other value or concern. How would that come in? How would new laws be then, you know, affected by this?
Okay, well, a couple things to understand. One is that the, well, first of all, new laws can be challenged by the investor state system. The what the trade agreements themselves build in a massive, when Congress votes for these trade agreements, what in effect they're voting for is a whole package of implementing legislation that changes domestic law to bring it into line with these trade agreements. So all these things are negotiated as to what the U.S. is agreeing to, and then Congress votes to, it's not just vote, it's voting on how domestic law will be changed in accordance with this international negotiation that Congress was locked out of. Congress is basically the power of, I mean, we talk about these agreements in terms of outsourcing jobs. These agreements actually outsource Congress, in effect, into this international negotiating process. Now, one of the scariest aspects of this is that there is just a leak this week concerning the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which has a regulatory cooperation chapter. Now, again, this is the sort of language that they use, regulatory cooperation, the sort of Orwellian language that sounds kind of nice. They use terms like cooperation and partnership and harmonization, all these very pleasant sounding words. Well, here's a quote from Paul de Klerk of Friends of the Earth Europe about what this chapter means in terms of what we know from the leaks. Here's the quote. The Commission proposal introduces a system that puts every new environmental, health, and labor standard at European and member state level at risk. It creates a labyrinth of red tape for regulators to be paid by the taxpayer that undermines their appetite to adopt legislation in the public interest. Now, regulatory cooperation refers to the harmonization of regulatory frameworks between the EU and the U.S. once the TTIP negotiations are done. So they're creating this new agency that laws will have to be checked in with to see how they affect the profits of corporations, creating new red tape against new legislation. So this is really a barrier to governments creating their own laws based on protecting corporate interests, based on protecting corporate profits. According to the Center for International Environmental Law, the chapter includes a regulatory exchange proposal which will force laws drafted by democratically elected politicians through an extensive screening process. Laws will be evaluated on whether or not they are compatible with the economic interests of major companies. Responsibility for the screening will lie with the regulatory cooperation body, a permanent, undemocratic, and unaccountable conclave of European and American technocrats. So this is really about creating a system of a regulatory management that supersedes democracy. Democracy is seen as an unnecessary obstacle. The idea of having elected officials in a public that has some limited say over who gets elected and what laws are created as a result is a deterrent to corporate profit. So they're simply creating a new system of government at the global level that eliminates that unnecessary obstacle. Noam Chomsky talks about how government has this democratic flaw, that the problem with government being this totalitarian institution is that in liberal democratic societies there is this opportunity for the public to have some input through the democratic process. What is being hidden into trade agreements here is nothing less than a global attempt to eliminate that flaw. The corporations that run absolute dictatorships in terms of how they manage their internal affairs, there aren't workers' councils voting for what goes on in their corporations. Unions have to fight tooth and nail to have any influence in the corporations within which they work. They want that kind of system not only internally but externally as well. The idea of the public, the people having any say over world affairs, the idea of the people having any say over whether water is considered a private resource or a public right, these are not the kind of things that we're supposed to have any say over. They want bureaucratic agencies run at the behest of corporations to be making these decisions. And that's really what these agreements are about. And for President Obama to be saying Elizabeth Warren is wrong and these trade agreements are about creating jobs and prosperity, I mean, I think a lot of people it's inflammatory language, but I think at this point there's nothing else to call him but a traitor. Because he really is at this point permanently betraying the public interest on behalf of corporate power, and in ways that are truly outrageous, that will in effect be permanent if these things go into power, and we can only act now to stop him. Time is limited. Fast track is being rushed ahead. They want to move a vote to the floor of Congress before anyone knows what's happening, before people really realize what is at stake. They have the media on board keeping the issue from people. They have Congress locked out of the negotiating process. They have this collusion between congressional Democrats and President Obama to push this all through on behalf of the corporations. Thankfully, there are some elected officials who are speaking out, and that we owe them our thanks for not going along with the program on this. And it is up to us to do our job and let the rest of those elected officials who have not spoken out, who are going along with the program, know that their political careers will be decided based on how they stand on this issue. That we will not forget, that we will not allow them to destroy what little democracy still remains in this society, and that we will hold them accountable for their fast-track votes at the ballot box. They need to know that now. They can't know that after the vote. It's too late. They need to hear from us right now. That we will hold them accountable for how they vote on Fast Track. And not speaking out about against Fast Track right now will be considered supporting it. So they need to be held accountable by us.
I just want to let listeners know that you can go to www.stopfasttrack.com, and by entering your zip code, you will either be able to email or directly phone, and all you have to do, they'll call you, and then they'll put you through to one of your congressional representatives and your senators after another until you can make your voices heard. This is something you could actually do on a daily basis. You don't have to just do it once and consider it done. You could do it over and over again. You could let other people No, I think it's really important to do it now. And the other thing I just wanted to say is, when you were saying what you just did, Adam, and it's, you know, it's like 99% accurate, but one thing that's also true is it's not just congressional Democrats who are working with the president. It's actually a lot of congressional Republicans. There are some who are libertarian, Tea Party, and other who are troubled by the issues of sovereignty that you discussed, and they see through this as being a problem. But there are other corporate Republicans who are very much on board with this, and there are many Democratic leaders, including Nancy Pelosi and many others who, you know, Harry Reid and others, who are dead on opposed to it, and that should tell us something, too, about what's going on here. A further thing to say is that if these treaties go through, your ability to write your congressional representatives about any issue whatsoever will be limited. The power that any and financial opportunity for anyone to serve in elected office is going to be drastically curtailed, and there's no doubt that some people, and of course, again, we don't have the smoking gun, we weren't in the backroom conversation, but there could be very incentive for some people who are currently serving in elected office, you know, to be offered tempting opportunities in the corporate world, where all of this will be, you know, which will be ruling, and where all of this will be implemented, because the ability of any elected official to do anything along, you know, a whole range of concerns once this happens is going to be curtailed, and it's going to be a thankless job in effect. And there are no doubt those who are, you know, going over, you know, and planning their future corporate careers when this kind of coup or whatever it is sort of, you know, if it were to move ahead. Now, I just, in line with that, and I just want to do that briefly, because then I want to ask you, Adam, a series of questions, because one of, but just very, very quickly, in calling my congresspeople and senators, I've learned that one senator I have, Senator Schumer, opposes this. Another one, Senator Gillibrand, this is of New York, is on the fence, and, you know, they have a sort of pat statement that you get if you call her office. They say, oh, we're waiting to hear what people think, you know. And the fact is that given the all the different groups that Adam mentioned at the beginning of the show, including the labor movement, the amount of people that are informed enough about the issue and likely making phone calls are bound to be much more against this than for it, you know, unless calls are being orchestrated, which I don't even, that could be, you know, that could possibly be. So the notion that she's waiting to hear from people when the people calling are mostly opposed is, I think, just a whitewash, and she's probably, you know, who knows what she's waiting for. And if you have any insight into that briefly, I'd like to hear that, and then we'll move on to some questions that I want to ask you that I think will be very helpful for people.
Well, just, one point I do want to clarify is that Nancy Pelosi is still considered on the fence on fast track. Harry Reid has been saying the right things. Pelosi still needs work. San Francisco just yesterday passed a resolution against fast track, so Nancy Pelosi should be listening to her own constituents. But in case she has not gotten the message yet, everyone in the country needs to call the most powerful Democrat in the House of Representatives and let her know that as a national leader, we in the entire country are counting on her and moreover demanding that she speak out against fast track. And furthermore, are outraged that she has not taken a hardline position on this already. Nancy Pelosi can be reached at 202-225-4965. I ask that every person listening to this program, as soon as the program is over, pick up your phone and call Nancy Pelosi. Again, her number is 202-225-4965. Regarding Senator Gillibrand, well, when she says she's waiting for the calls, you know, I think the right question is whose calls are she waiting? Is she waiting for? And you know, how many zeros are they adding at the end of those checks? If she has not given an answer yet to this question, I actually think that in the end she is going to vote the right way on this. But I will say that I'm not pleased that she hasn't taken a strong position yet. Senator Schumer has not traditionally been a loyal ally on trade agreements, but he is, has been saying a lot of good things about TPP and Fast Track in terms of he's co-sponsored a petition addressing asking the question of why Congress, saying that Congress should have the right to amend trade agreements. He's been very critical of the failure to address the issue of currency manipulation in TPP. He's been highly critical of the investor, the investment chapter in TPP, which, the chapter that creates the system of investor tribunals for, where corporations can sue governments outside of our court system. So thankfully, Senator Schumer is on the right side of this issue. His neighbors across the Hudson River in New Jersey still definitely need some work. Bob Menendez, you know, in between, maybe he's been too busy with some of his legal issues, but he has not certainly spoken out in the same way that Senator Schumer has. Cory Booker, the number one Wall Street recipient of Wall Street cash, probably has a lot to think about in determining where he stands on this issue. But so for folks like me in New Jersey, we need to be calling our senators. That address that you gave before, the website, that'll take you to your House members, but we need to be calling our senators as well. The House is where the really key battle is. But we also want to make sure...
Actually, that Stop Fast Track takes us to both the House and the Senate.
Oh,
actually,
that does the House and the Senate, okay.
Yeah, it does both. Now, I just want to go, we'll circle around back about like what's upcoming on this vote, but I just want to ask you a few questions because one of the things that I'm hearing a great deal, you know, in social media and everything is, like, you know, you mentioned, we both mentioned the possibility of New York State being sued over its fracking ban. We've mentioned that these bills, and you know, have a nefarious effect on climate change. And yet, many of the groups that represent these specific niche interests are not kind of clued in to the threat posed by these bills, or are not as active, you know, by these treaties, and are not active on these fronts. So, what I'd like to do with you is kind of do a rundown of, you know, where the movement is today, and then you're telling us where the signing of these treaties would take that their concerns and their current issue, if you'd like to do that. So, for example, right now, when I'm on social media, a lot of people have finally gotten the message. I mean, not everyone throughout the whole country, of course. There's still problem areas, but the kind of people that would be opposed to these treaties, you know, if they understood them fully, you know, have gotten the message about climate change. Furthermore, 350.org, the large organization that was the lead initiator of the recent climate march this past year, you know, is pushing a divestment campaign where different universities divest of their financial portfolios in fossil fuel activities of various kinds. So they've been pushing that in order to lower fossil fuel activity in order to slow climate change. It's like, let's put our money where our mouth is. excellent idea. I've reported on that. Terrific. But during this whole thing, 350, you know, has an occasional email or an occasional bleep, but they're really not discussing these treaties at all. How would these treaties affect climate change vis-a-vis, you know, would it be more powerful to withdraw our monies from fossil fuel companies if we're investors, which I don't know how many people, you know, are through pension funds or other things or institutional investors. Is, you know, obviously that's a good thing to do, but is the threat posed by the treaties to climate change even greater than, you know, maintaining that status quo temporarily and then turning your attention to address the treaties as an organization?
I mean, I think organizations have a lot of important things to work on. I'm glad that 350 has addressed TPP to the degree that they have. I would, you know, love to see just about everyone address it as much as they can. But I do think that we absolutely need to recognize that TPP and these other agreements are a major issue for climate change. Just to give an example of the agreement that is being negotiated this week in New York, the TTIP, there is actually a leaked memorandum regarding fossil fuel exports under TTIP. What we know with TTIP is that TTIP will not only require exports of liquid natural gas, but it will require changes in U.S. laws prohibiting the export of crude oil. So these trade agreements are by design intended to increase the international trade in fossil fuels. They are not about transitioning to a clean energy economy, just the opposite. They are about digging in even deeper into the fossil fuel economy. They give corporations the right to sue local governments when they pass legislation that restricts fossil fuel activities. And you can say, well, how do you know that? That's you're just being suspicious. Well, we know that because it's happened. We know that because these kind of investment rules exist in past trade agreements. There's a case right now under NAFTA where a Canadian company, now just a bit of background here, what's something that we have to understand about these trade agreements, and one of the things that makes them the most outrageous, is that they create this system where foreign governments gain greater rights than the corporations of a particular country. If you are a Japanese company, you can go to one of these tribunals under TPP, and sue the U.S. in a way that a U.S. company couldn't directly sue the U.S. in a U.S. court or in one of these tribunals. So what companies will sometimes do is they'll set up dummy operations in other countries just in order to be able to access the trade agreement. So this Canadian
I don't want to go into depth on the Canadian thing because we have covered it in past programs.
Okay.
And it's also, I know that it's a little bit of a complicated story, but what I'm trying to go for here is, if we get some institutions divesting their fossil fuel holdings, but these treaties go through and the companies can sue or enforce laws that allow, the expansion of excavation activities, do we have a net win at the end of the day versus if we, you know, hit the pause button on divestment activities and stop these treaties now? I know that's a bit of a tough question to answer.
Yeah, I think clearly that we're at a moment of crisis, so I would love it if people put this issue front and center. I'm not going to be in a position of telling people, your campaign is less important than some other campaign, but I do want to tell everyone that this is a key moment, that this is a critical fight, and that we have a lot of long-term battles, but this is a battle that is really going to be won or lost in the next 2 weeks. So if for 2 weeks everyone wanted to say, hey, this has to be front and center between now and, I mean, probably less than 2 weeks when we're looking at a fast-track vote, the implications of this will be felt for years and years to come, perhaps into the indefinite future. So absolutely, I think people at this particular moment should really put this issue at the front of their agendas. Because, yes, we will be looking at such a wide range of climate attacks. We're talking about attacks on government procurement rules, like buy green rules. Like, we're talking about expanding the unsustainable food economy, leading to the globalization of unsustainable diets and corporate food, and a global expansion of consumption of GHG-intensive animal products, which is a major driver of climate change. We're talking about the fossil fuel industry gaining new powers. A lot of these investment rules are designed to increase the to increase the fossil fuel industry's interest in new extraction. And new infrastructure development for fuel transport, for coal export, for oil export, for LNG export, and new rights to really protect their interests against environmental laws wherever they go. So, yes, I think people should make this a top priority issue, and should really understand just how dangerous these trade agreements are in terms of climate. We have a section of our website at Global Justice for Animals and the Environment where people can read more about the climate connection to this issue. It is gjae.org/climate. I'm just checking to make sure that's the right link. gjae.org/climate, all lowercase, and that'll take you to a page with lots of resources on the trade agreements and climate. And you can find out about the connection to fracking, the connection to animal agriculture. There's a presentation by Naomi Klein. There's a slide presentation. So if you want to talk to climate activists on this issue, there are lots of resources to do that. And I would definitely encourage the climate change movement to seize this moment and take action while we can.
Thank you. Now, I actually had somebody tweet a quick question for you, and we only have about, 2 minutes more for our program here, so, I don't know if you can tackle it that rapidly, but, let's kind of see what we can do. One of the things that happened when President Obama was on MSNBC, which you referenced, is that he said that Elizabeth Warren had her facts wrong, and that the facts show that, in fact, this is a great, signing these treaties is a great move for us. What facts was he referring to, and what do, in fact, the facts show?
The facts show that this trade agreement is a jobless trade agreement. President Obama, during the State of the Union, talked about Peterson Institute numbers about how this trade agreement was going to create over 500,000 new jobs. The pro-free trade Washington Post even had to give him four Pinocchio noses for that one in their fact checker because of the fact that those numbers, actually his own source says that this is going to create no new jobs. This is not, at least not in the U.S., it'll create new sweatshop jobs to be sure. It'll help corporations move jobs from workers who are paid decent wages and have labor rights to more exploited workers who have miserable wages, terrible labor conditions, and then given the ability to export goods back to the U.S. tariff-free. So yes, if those are the jobs he's talking about creating, that'll happen. It certainly will create prosperity and opportunity for corporate executives to profit more on more labor exploitation. So that's a fact. He's right about that. But that's not what he's telling us. He's telling us that these trade agreements are about advancing the interests of the middle class, and we know that that's not true at all. Center for Economic and Policy Institute says that 90% of U.S. wages will go down as a result of this trade, of the TPP. So this is not a middle-class job creation agreement. This is not a wage-lifting agreement. This is not a labor rights agreement. These agreements are just the opposite. And I know we're running out of time, so
yeah.
I just really want to let my fellow New York area people know that what's very exciting, we have a vote coming up next week on making New York City a TPP-free zone. And you can find out about that by going to our website at tradejustice.net/events. So much going on right now. There's a press conference tomorrow at the TTIP negotiations. We're rallying tomorrow and against Congressman Crowley and next week against Congressman Rangel. The level of activity is at a fever pitch because it has to be in the New York area and throughout the country. So people are maybe wondering what we can do. All you need to do is plug in because people are already working on these things. If you are not sure who to talk to in your community, we'd be happy to let you know. There are great groups working on these issues from a broad range of movements. You can email us at info@tradejustice.net, look at our websites at tradejustice.net and gjae.org, and you can find lots of resources. We can every Sunday night there are national conference calls where you can learn more about these issues and how they affect access to medicines and how they affect the environment and how they affect our jobs. Every Wednesday there are national phone briefings. So there's so many ways to plug in, find other people working on these issues, learn the facts, and get involved. Just do it now. And
thank you,
because
thank
it'll
you,
be too
Adam,
late
so
very
much.
Soon.
we're come to the end of our time. You're so well informed, so active, such a leader in activism. Listeners, follow Adam's lead and get involved with all the suggestions that he makes. Thank you so much for being with us this week on Connect the Dots, Adam Weissman. It's been terrific having you. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. And come back next week at 10 a.m. Wednesday, Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday. And we're here with you every week. And we'll be doing another TPP show. And then let's hope that we prevail. Let's hope that the people prevail. Now is our chance. I'm Allison Rosini. There was me, but there was the same.